326-1234. Going on tomorrow night, the Armory Arts and Events Center in Park Rapids has a very good Christmas carol. It's a humorous take on Dickens with three ghosts, two actors, and one helpful audience. Free performances tomorrow night at 7, Saturday at 2 p.m. Also going on tomorrow, the Bemidji Night We Light Parade is at 6 p.m. It's mainly on Beltrami Avenue. You follow the parade, head to the waterfront as the switch is flipped to light up the town. Also a festival of lights tomorrow in downtown Walker. Their parade begins at 5, tree lighting at 6 o'clock. The Northern Lakes Chapter, the Minnesota Dark House and Angling Association has their annual fish decoy and sporting show Saturday from 9 to 4 at Timber Lake Lodge. Up next, we've got news from our region. It is the Up North Report. It is 7:01.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with a special edition of the Up North Report. If you're headed to spend time with family this Thanksgiving, you might be bracing yourself for heated political exchanges or other conflicts that can arise when you're with your loved ones. Lori Kramer is a professor of applied psychology at Northeastern University in Boston. She is an expert in managing strategies for family conflict. I spoke with Kramer about how to prepare yourself for family gatherings and how to leave them relatively unscathed.
First of all, have a little talk with yourself about what this is likely going to be like. Think about what's happening within your family, how people are getting along, which people may have belief systems that may really differ from your own, but who also in the family may be more likely to see things the way that you do. And you may want to have a conversation with those folks ahead of time to brainstorm together about what you might do. Should the conversation turn in ways that might create more tension? Think about your own emotion, how you can enter a family gathering feeling as calm and relaxed as you possibly can, but also realize that this is a temporary situation. I don't have to spend all the rest of my days dealing with these contentious issues with people that I care about. Do some relaxation or yoga or whatever people do to really help themselves calmly enter a situation like that.
My mind goes toward having a drink or two. That's something that people will do on Thanksgiving. They'll imbibe. Can you talk about how that may play into the development of some of these conflicts that occur?
Right. So there's many different ways to relax. If you are using alcohol, I think it's important to realize that that does loosen people's inhibitions. And it may increase the likelihood that people say things to each other that they may find hurtful or painful. I'm a strong proponent of having people think about what their goals are. How can they leave that family gathering and still feel good about themselves and feel good about their families? That may lead them to make some decisions about really how much they want to drink, to realize that that's part of the context that they're walking into.
So let's say you feel the need to step in and be the peacemaker. What would be some good techniques to use to take the temperature down a notch or two?
Humor is always one strategy. If you can come up with something that is just a funny thing to talk about to change the subject, or be a little self-effacing of, I want to tell you how I feel, but maybe this isn't the right place or time. And being transparent about your goal. Came here today because I really want to spend time with people I love. There's always past the peas, you know. Get back into the food and maybe coming prepared preemptively to have a list of five things that you could bring up would be more likely to bring people together than apart. If there's no way to avoid those difficult conversations, to be really upfront, you care, you're curious, you are open and interested in hearing what about their viewpoint. That often disarms people. They may open up and be a little bit less defensive and share a little bit more about their viewpoints in ways that you can then respond with interest and curiosity, not rejection.
How do you recommend approaching that situation when you know for a fact that something is wrong?
It sounds like you know that if you just say, that's not true, that might not lead to the response that you're hoping for. Instead, stepping back a minute and follow your curiosity. How did you find that out? How did you come to believe that? As they give more of the details, you may be able to find some entry points for helping to show that there's other evidence that they may want to look at too. Hey, I'm so glad you have an open mind about this, but there's this other article you may want to read, and it will let you see a different perspective on this very same issue.
That was Lori Kramer, professor of applied psychology at Northeastern University. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. Happy Thanksgiving from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
You should give as you are able, because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely Northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time. This is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you for your support.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California. Two West Virginia National Guard members are in critical condition after they were shot near the White House in Washington, D.C. Wednesday afternoon. The city's mayor described the attack as targeted. The suspected gunman, who was also shot, is in custody. And the attack comes as President Trump has deployed the National Guard to several cities around the country, a pattern that has been controversial and challenged in the courts. For more, we're joined by NPR's Kat Lonsdorf. Kat, tell us about what happened with the shooting.
Yeah, the shooting occurred about 2:15 p.m. yesterday. At a press conference, the D.C. Metropolitan Police said that the gunman came around a corner and opened fire at the guard members while they were on patrol. Nearby guard members quickly intervened and subdued the shooter. Police say it's unclear at this time who shot the shooter. The two injured guard members, who, like you said, were from West Virginia, were both rushed to hospitals. Earlier yesterday, West Virginia Governor Patrick Morrisey had said the guard members were killed, but walked that back less than an hour later. Authorities have since said that the two are in critical condition.
And it sounds like the president is talking about the suspected shooter.
Yeah, in a video statement yesterday, President Trump said the shooter was someone who came to the U.S. from Afghanistan. The Department of Homeland Security later identified the shooter as Rahmanullah Lakhanwal and said he came to the U.S. as part of a Biden administration program called Operation Allies Welcome that allowed thousands of Afghans to enter the country after the Taliban retook power of Afghanistan back in 2021. Those people came in on two-year grants of parole, then later had to apply for other ways to stay in the country permanently, like asylum, and go through rigorous screening. NPR has not yet independently verified when or why Lakhanwal entered the country, and a motive for the shooting is not yet known. In that video last night, Trump called the attack an act of terror.
We must now re-examine every single alien who has entered our country from Afghanistan under Biden.
He also repeated anti-immigrant rhetoric. The Trump administration then announced that it had stopped processing immigration applications for Afghan nationals. And A, this will likely affect a number of Afghans who worked with the U.S. government or NATO forces during the 20-year war in Afghanistan and have largely been left in limbo after the Trump administration curbed immigration.
Yeah. Now, the National Guard, back to them for a second, because they've been in D.C. for a few months now. Why were they sent here in the first place?
Yeah, there have been more than 2,000 National Guard troops in D.C. from several states, including West Virginia, since August, when Trump ordered the deployment over concerns about the city's crime rate. This has been part of a pattern of Trump deploying the National Guard to Democratic-led cities around the country, often against the wishes of local governors and authorities. And D.C. is unique. Unlike the 50 states, the president has the authority to deploy the National Guard to D.C. I live in D.C., and in the past few months, I see members of the National Guard pretty much every day. They're out patrolling the streets in groups, and they've been helping with beautification efforts. But these deployments have been very controversial. In places like Portland, Oregon, or Chicago, federal judges almost immediately intervened and blocked them. Those are still tied up in legal battles. And in D.C., a federal judge just last week ruled that the use of troops in the city was unlawful and ordered an end to the deployment. That has yet to take effect to give the administration time to appeal. Meanwhile, after yesterday's attack, Trump doubled down, saying he was ordering an additional 500 troops to the city.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf. Kat, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more about this shooting and the investigation, we've called Juliet Kayyem. She served as Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Department of Homeland Security during the Obama administration. As the Homeland Security Advisor in Massachusetts, she oversaw the state's National Guard. Today, she serves as Faculty Chair of the Homeland Security Project at Harvard University. So, Juliet, this shooting, is it possible to change maybe the way in which Guard members are preparing for missions on the streets of major American cities now?
It would be possible, but it has to begin with understanding what the mission is. And I think that's one of the challenges right now. The National Guard in D.C., like all the other National Guards deployed by President Trump, were sent to essentially blue cities to do what's called high visibility patrols. These are, you know, these are literally what, as advertised. These are, you want the Trump administration wanted a lot of members of the National Guard in uniform to essentially just sort of roam the street. Some of them do beautification campaigns. So it's difficult to know how you would better protect, for example, the troops, the National Guard troops deployed in cities under the mission that they are in right now.
Yeah. Now, President Trump has called for the deployment of 500 more National Guard troops in Washington, considering everything that's happened, not only just recently, but in the last few months. What do you think that might do to the safety of members of the Guard and for the people of D.C.?
So 500 is not a lot sort of overall, but it's a lot for D.C., considering the deployment has just been a couple thousand. I think we err in believing that quantity is the problem, right? That if only we did more troops, then they would be safer. That's just not a sophisticated way of looking at it. The problem is the mission. We have deployed National Guard members who join the National Guard not for these purposes. They join the National Guard to support and their neighbors in their states. They've been deployed to D.C. under a very nebulous mission, and it's the mission that is the challenge, right? It's what are they there for? What are the rules of engagement? What are the metrics for success? What's our standard operating procedures? All the questions that you would ask in any normal situation have not been asked or defined by the Pentagon. So its response yesterday was, okay, well, we'll just add more, as if that is the problem. It is not. The challenge is, of course, protecting the National Guard when they're deployed. And that begins with understanding and defining for them what the mission is.
Considering, Juliet, how closely you've worked the National Guard over the years, I'm wondering if you've heard from people who have chosen to enlist in this part-time military service. What have they been saying?
So most have not chosen it, and most are confused by it. I have strong ties with National Guard members in my state of Massachusetts, but elsewhere, and have spoken to many of them that have been deployed in other cities. And I mean, the data is pretty clear. There's been some polling that this is a deployment that they don't understand and don't particularly like. It is a deployment that their leadership doesn't know how to explain. I mean, for someone who, you know, these victims from West Virginia, you know, they're taken from their homes, from their home state. They are sent to a city where they know no one. They are taken away from their jobs because most National Guard members are not full-time. and they are deployed in conflict with a city that they don't know, but it's an American city. It's been confusing for everyone all around, and that's why in the past, regardless of what the legal standards are, this has never been done in the past, to deploy a military asset for traditional law enforcement purposes or beautification purposes, which serve no public safety aim.
President Trump also said the U.S. must, quote, re-examine every Afghan who came here since the Taliban fell. Juliet, how would that logistically work?
The Trump administration will essentially, I think there's no question about it, close all processes for Afghans right now that have been trying to make permanent their immigration status. What that looks like a few weeks or months from now, we don't know. But there are a lot of Afghans who supported us, the United States, during the Afghan war, who have been brought to the United States or are pending permanent status in the United States for their support of us in the Afghan war, who are now going to be impacted quite negatively by the actions of one individual from Afghanistan.
That's former Homeland Security official Juliet Kayyem, who chairs the Homeland Security Project at Harvard's Kennedy School. Juliet, thanks for sharing some of your Thanksgiving with us.
Thank you.
The government shutdown affected federal assistance programs such as SNAP and Head Start. WPLN's Cynthia Abrams reports on the impact to a lesser-known lifeline.
The shutdown ended on November 12th, but back when the government was still closed, mother of two, Denise Simpson, visited Nashville's Metro Action Commission, a local agency that helps people in poverty. Simpson is a SNAP recipient, and without that federal food aid, costs were mounting. Those benefits have since resumed.
It's been tough, especially being a mother of two boys and one of them being special needs. And he requires so much. It's hard to be able to take care of your family that's needed.
Simpson is applying for the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, otherwise known as LIHEAP. The federal program that's administered through states provides one-time payments to people who need help with their gas or electric bills. Simpson says she needs that help, especially as temperatures drop, to keep her family secure.
I don't care what nobody says, you have to be supermom with assistance. It takes a village.
But weeks after applying, Simpson hasn't heard back. That's because during the shutdown, none of the funds from LIHEAP were dispersed. In Tennessee, that's roughly $72 million.
As the program was delayed, the more families found themselves in crisis.
That's Lisa McCrady-Beverly, who works for Metro Action.
And then during all of this, we had the disruption as it relates to SNAP. And so when you have all of those different scenarios with families or individuals whose incomes are already very, very limited, it exacerbates the situations that they're already having to deal with.
As families face a delay, a spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services, which releases the funds to states, tells NPR News that it is, quote, moving swiftly to distribute annual awards. An HHS official not authorized to speak publicly said the funds should be released by the end of the month. But Tennessee still hasn't received them. Meanwhile, residents are in need. So far in November, the state has received close to 13,000 applications for utility assistance. For NPR News in Nashville, I'm Cynthia Abrams.
This is NPR News.
It's 7:19. More news coming up from Morning Edition. Then we bring you Best wishes, our daily dose of phenology, and a conversation with Tammy Bobrowski. Tammy is talking to Mike Herbert, a professor emeritus from Bemidji State University, about his recent research and book on World War II, Women from Beltrami County. Don't forget, there's a lot of free Thanksgiving meals all across our region. That includes the Triumphant Life Church in Bovee hosting their 17th annual free Thanksgiving community meal from 11 to 5, and Floodwood New Life Community Church hosting a free public meal at noon today. We received support this morning from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender. Thanks also goes out this morning to Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone. They're a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. KEXE News is working on a story explaining the complex workings behind your property taxes, but we need your help. It's confidential. Share your property tax statement and your questions. Email news at kexe.org. More news is next.
From the station and from Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. Forget about the turkey, the cranberry sauce, the wiggly, jiggly jello salad. Have we got some Thanksgiving traditions for you? Our crack team of researchers have scoured the country in search of eight traditional traditions that'll make you rethink your Thanksgiving. We start in Boston, where turkey isn't just a meal, it is a projectile. Radio station KISS 108 has been holding a turkey-tossing contest for as long as anyone can remember. Local high schools compete to see who can hurl and catch a frozen bird. And before you cry foul, KISS 108's Billy Costa says turkey-tossing is a whole lot harder than it looks.
It's kind of heavy to just pick it up and throw it like a football. So the motion is that they have their back to the receiver and they bend their knees and they go into usually a two or three step pump, you know, pump one, pump two, pump three. And then in the air goes the bird. It's frozen solid, by the way. So the impact of the toss usually will knock them down onto their backs.
So if someone establishes a successful catch and another team beats them, will the original team be allowed to try and best the other team's length?
No, there are no redos. You get one shot, and the school that throws and catches it the furthest wins. And I got to tell you, immediately, pandemonium on the field.
Everett High School has won the turkey toss 5 years in a row. Football players Shane McKenzie and Dominic Papa were the 2023 champions. So, Dominic, I know that in football, you're taught to catch the ball out in front and then bring it into your body. Because if you catch it with your chest, I mean, that means the ball typically, or the bird in this case, will kind of bounce off your chest and you lose. So how much of the way football is played is applicable here?
Nowhere near what catching a turkey is. I kind of make like a basket, and like while like it's falling down on me, I kind of like fall down with the turkey. So like the momentum of the turkey is just coming down with me.
What would you say, Dominic, are some of the top mistakes that catchers make in the turkey toss?
Maybe being too scared of how heavy it is and how like it's like a brick.
Yeah.
You can't be scared of the bird.
Can't be scared of the bird. No, I know you can't be scared of the bird. Shane, and championships to uphold. I mean, that's some pressure. I mean, for the people that follow you.
Oh, I've played in multiple playoff overtime games, you know, in football in my career. As crazy as it sounds, you have the entire city tuning in to watch this thing. It was the most pressure I've ever felt in my entire life. Ever.
Would it be fair, Shane, to say that this is, at the moment, your biggest accomplishment in life?
I wouldn't go as far as saying that, but it's probably number two.
All right, blunt force trauma to the chest is not your idea of a good Thanksgiving. No problem. I understand. Why don't you head out then to the Santa Barbara Zoo in California? Every Thanksgiving, it gives leftover Halloween pumpkins to the animals. Ellie Cullip is a senior keeper there.
We truly only give them pumpkins this one time a year. We love stimulating our animals and enriching them and getting them to engage in things. And the animals at the zoo are intelligent enough to understand when the keepers are giving them something new and different.
Some animals like to eat the pumpkin.
Our capybaras will eat them entirely. They'll eat every last little morsel of it. We have macaws and cockatoos. And there's one cockatoo in particular. His name is Reggie. He's a sulfur-crested cockatoo, and he loves to destroy the pumpkin.
Turns out Reggie is a bit of a show-off.
He feeds off of people's reactions to him, so I think he has such a blast not only destroying the pumpkin, but having people watch him destroy the pumpkin.
Other animals enjoy a more subtle pumpkin experience.
We'll give them to our big cats as like a different scent that they love to just like smell and rub on.
The Pumpkin Love Fest draws thousands of visitors to the zoo.
It's almost as popular as a busy 4th of July weekend.
In other words, it's a gorgeous day for all. Now on to southern Iowa, where Danish immigrants settled in the 1800s. Two towns, Elk Ridge and Kimbleton, have celebrated Yule Fest the Friday and Saturday after Thanksgiving for 47 years. It's a festival to kick off the Christmas season. Organizer Sean Sayers said Yule Fest wouldn't be Yule Fest without a specific Danish-American food, and I'm going to let him pronounce it.
Æbleskiver med ostepølse, which is essentially for the non-Danish pancakes and sausage. The æbleskiver is a special round pancake, so it's a sphere rather than flat. And then medisterpølse is a special kind of sausage that in Denmark is not eaten with æbleskiver whatsoever. And Danes actually think this tradition is very odd, but to Americans it seems more stereotypical or normal.
He had me at pancakes and sausage, but nothing puts the medisterpølse in the æbleskiver quite like the traditional Danish Christmas drink known as glug.
I call it drinking a Christmas candle, except without all the carcinogens.
Glug is made from a mix of cinnamon, cloves, and cardamom combined with a sweet red table wine.
So if you want to have a child-friendly get-together or no alcohol involved, you can easily cut it with apple cider. That works really well.
Then you heat it up.
Either on the stove or a crock pot, or you can do kind of one of those party coffee canisters. And you take the lid off and just let the steam out, and it fills your whole house with this just wonderful aroma. It's important to us to remind ourselves that we are a community, and this is what we were founded with, and this is how we link together, and showing future generations that this is what being a community means. It's to have traditions, it's to have focal points as a means of coming together.
Whether you find that community by flinging frozen turkeys, watching animals annihilate pumpkins, or drinking too much glug at Yule Fest, it's okay to be different at Thanksgiving. As Winnie the Pooh's friend Piglet said, the things that make me different are the things that make me me. Happy Thanksgiving. This is NPR News.
This is the Thursday morning show on this Thanksgiving. I'm Heidi Holton at 7:30. Thanks for being here. We've got some best wishes coming up next, our daily dose of phonology, and then we get to a conversation from our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. We want to know what you are grateful for this year. That is our question of the week. Each week, we pose a question, helps connect us. and tell stories throughout our region. You can text 218-326-1234. Expecting partly sunny skies to mostly cloudy, highs in the mid-20s, northwest winds 10 to 20, evening temperatures in the low teens, and mostly cloudy tomorrow Friday to partly sunny, highs near 23 with calm winds. Don't forget, our Season Watch pod is now live. Each week, you get a little dip into nature. We've got winter on our hands, and we've got lots of students telling us about what they have been seeing. You can hear it on the radio Saturdays at 1:30, Sundays at 10:30, or sign up for it through the podcast platform you use, like Spotify or Apple. We receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair as well as auto glass replacement. Dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident, more information at dalesautobodyinc.com. We'd also like to thank Sanford Health. They have primary care locations in Bemidji and across the upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Lots of things going on in our region, from free Thanksgiving meals today at places like the Sand Lake Community Center in Spring Lake. That's at 2 p.m. and the Old Scenic Community Church in Big Fork at from 1 to 4. You can find a list of free Thanksgiving meals at our website right now at kaxe.org. Then for the weekend, tomorrow, 1 p.m., Aiken Fish House Parade. With a variety of events before and after the parade, a full schedule is at aiken.com/fishhouseparade. Also going on in Nisswa, it is the 44th Annual City of Lights event. The celebration includes food vendors, the Polar Express storytelling, Santa's petting zoo, bonfires, train rides, carolers, and fireworks. And the Heartland Lakes Community Tree Lighting is tomorrow as well at 6 p.m. in downtown Park Rapids. Many local businesses will be taking part in a Yuletide sampler that evening. And you can find Santa and Mrs. Claus at Bella Cafe. This Sunday, the Essentia Health Fauston has its 21st annual tree walk for hospice. It's at Maglison Elementary School. The Fauston Langby Lions Club has a pancake breakfast from 10 to noon. There'll be a remembrance program and candle lighting ceremony at 12:15. Attendees can stroll through decorated Christmas trees and bid in a silent auction. Don't forget, you can cut your own Christmas tree in the Superior or Chippewa National Forest. Permits are now available at recreation.gov. You may also stop by a district office to get a permit. We receive support from Harmony Food Co-op, Bemidji's full-service downtown grocery store, offering people a variety of local, organic, fair trade, and conventional items. Open daily from 8 to 8, more at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. It is Thursday, November 27th, and time for best wishes. We do our best to wish our friends and neighbors happy birthday and happy anniversary. Today, not friends and neighbors. We have no one in our book. Maybe it's your birthday or anniversary. We wish you the best. But looking at some well-known people who celebrate on this day, Charles M. Schulz from Minnesota, the cartoonist of Peanuts, who brought us the great pumpkin, and of course, the wonderful music of Vince Guaraldi, Robert Goulet, the actor and singer, and the accomplished, amazing singer, Tina Turner, all celebrating birthdays today. We'll celebrate them with some local music right now from Grand Rapids' own Wild Horses.
There searching for the end of the road that I was on, but instead I just kept drifting from the path that I and I even set out on. I was wandering slowly from where I was. There was no help to be found in the times that I was in. There was a time or two that I could have called it the end. I was hanging on still, hanging on still, where I lie. I was wandering slowly towards the sky. When I was younger, I was up beside there. He said to me, son, don't ever call my name. When the time comes up, I can find you. I wish to remind you when I'm home again. It'll be the last time I ever see you. Still pressing onwards, I found a gentle hole where I could rest. And finding shelter there, I put my wits and my temptations to the test. There's not a soul here, not a soul here like the rest. I could call it home, dear, call it home, dear, and be blessed. When I was younger, I was up beside there. He said to me, son, don't ever call my name. When the time comes up, I can find you. I wish to remind you when I'm home again. It'll be the last time I ever see you. My thoughts were drifting down the road.
Today's date, November 28th, 1999, the Bohemian Waxwings have once again returned to northern Minnesota. They'll be regular visitors throughout the winter, wherever they can find a tree with some fruit left on it. They come in big flocks, and they never seem to stay in an area very long. Once they've exhausted the fruit of the trees, they will move on to the next spot, next town maybe. but they are certainly vagabonds in their own way and style. One of the interesting features about Bohemian waxwings is that as they fly in a flock together, they will circle about a tree preparatory to landing and come to the tree into the wind. They always land facing into the wind. So if you happen to be watching a flock of waxwings and they spin about a big tree, maybe where they're going to stop and rest, and as they come into the tree, if you note the direction that they're flying, that will tell you which direction the wind is blowing.
John Latimer and our Daily Dose of Phenology. If you missed the full phenology, it's available right now at our website, kaxe.org, along with the student reports that came in this week. And the Season Watch podcast this week is live. You can get it at our website at kaxe.org. Coming up at 8:10, it is Points North from our friends at Interlochen Public Radio in Michigan. They are bringing us a story of a man named Bugsy Sailor. He made a New Year's resolution in 2019 to watch every sunrise over Lake Superior that year. He has continued to do that into 2025. We'll hear his story. Also, Aaron Brown coming up before 9 o'clock, and he and I are going to be talking about gratefulness for grandpas. It is Thanksgiving, and I'm grateful that you're here with us. I'm Heidi Holton. Programming this morning comes from you, our listener supporter, as well as Klocko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids. They make traditional old world styles of beer and modern classics for 8 years now. Their tap room open Monday through Thursday, 3 to 8, Friday, Saturday, noon to 8, and Sunday from noon to 6. More info at klockobrewing.com. We'd also like to thank Minnesota Power. They're an elite company powering the region's homes, businesses, and industries since 1923. Learn more about its vision of a carbon-free future at mnpower.com/energyforward. Right now, a conversation from our staff librarian. This is a new podcast that Tammy's been working on. She is a librarian at Bemidji State University, and she is talking here with Professor Emeritus Michael Herbert, PhD. He's got a new book out, They Answered the Call, Minnesota's Beltrami County Women Who Served in the Military During World War II.
My name is Mike Herbert. I'm a professor emeritus from Bemidji State University. I retired 2 years ago from BSU, and after teaching part-time, full-time for a total of 33 years. Prior to that, I was in law enforcement for 22 years, and as an undergrad, I attended Marine Corps Officer Training School in Quantico, Virginia.
So your previous book is called Leaving Campus, A World War II Epitaph, and it's an account of the 20 men originally here at Bemidji State College as students who then volunteered for military service and later lost their lives in service. So this new book that we're going to talk about is sharing specifically the stories of the women who served. What got you interested in bringing these stories together for both these men and women who served?
Well, I think it was... The first book was about the Bemidji State College students who volunteered for military service, and they didn't have to. Because they were college students, they were exempt from the draft at that time, but they volunteered anyway. And I started thinking, I was assuming there were quite a few women from Beltrami County that also volunteered for military service who did not have to. And so I thought it was important that that we keep their memories alive, too. They were just as brave and served our country honorably, and they deserve to be recognized.
Okay, so according to your research, how many women in Beltrami County enlisted in the war?
That's a really good question, and I struggled with that a little bit because What I'm afraid of is that someone who reads the book or that hears this podcast or whatever, they're going to say, wait, my grandmother was in there. And I'm sure I missed, I missed some. But I was comfortable when I finished with the book that I'd reached out as much as I could. I used social media, flyers around town. I mean, I did as much as I could. And so I'm comfortable with the amount of people that I was able to find. And that was, I believe, 102 women that are in the book.
I'm a little overwhelmed at the scope of this. How did you actually get a list of these women? Did you have to really dig through the archives and newspapers? Can you talk about that process?
Well, as you know, I lived in the archives for about 2 years, going through every Northern student that I could find, social media, the National Archives. There are genealogy websites out there. There are military websites out there. There were a lot of resources for me to have access to that really allowed me to put this book together.
It's not like there was a list available that certain people went to Bemidji State College. So, did you glean that information basically from the newspaper articles and archives? Was there documentation here at Bemidji State that said these people served, or was that a bigger project as far as digging into finding that information?
Yeah, that's another great question. Bemidji State actually has a list of all of the students, male students, but not the female students.
Okay.
So, I mean, that speaks loudly when you think about the 1940s. So no, there wasn't a list anywhere that I could say, oh, hey, here they are, kind of a thing. So yeah, that made it much more difficult.
For sure, yeah. So in what capacity did women serve when we're talking about World War II?
Well, they served in all four branches of the military, as well as the WASP program, and we'll talk a little bit about that probably more, but which was women air transport. Women air service pilots who were trained under the military but weren't actually considered part of the military. The first military branch to accept women was the Army, and it was first called the Women's Auxiliary Army Corps, WAAC, mm-hmm. And then after about a year, it changed just to the Women's Auxiliary Corps, Women's Army Corps, right, excuse me. Second was the Navy, and they were the WAVES. Their acronym was Women Accepted for Voluntary Emergency Service.
Okay.
So, and then we had the Coast Guard, and they were the SPARs, and that was short for Semper Paratus, which means always ready. Lastly were the Marines. Big surprise. The commandant of the Marine Corps at that period in time said, if we're going to accept women, they're going to be Marines. They're not going to have an acronym. If they're a Marine, they're a Marine. Right. And then I mentioned the WASP program, right, as well.
So in the research for this book, in researching the women who served in this county, did many women die in service?
Not from Beltrami County.
Okay.
The numbers are a little off, but if you look at what I'm going to call the quasi-legitimate sources that list the number of women killed in World War II, is right around 500.
Oh.
Some sites say a little bit fewer, some sites say a little bit more, but the average would be about 500 women that actually died in military service in World War II.
And were they on the front line, or was it artillery? I mean, just what were the circumstances that this would happen?
Most of the time they were nurses. And so, for example, they would not be on the front lines, but they would be right behind the front lines with their field hospitals, right? And sometimes they would get artillery shells into the camps or into the hospitals, or they would be flight nurses and the aircraft would crash and kill everybody aboard, that kind of thing. So that was most typical of, it was nurses typically that were killed because of those kinds of circumstances.
So you've come up with 102 women from Beltrami County who you include in this book. These are all notable women for the service that they've done. Are there any particular women or stories that really stuck out for you? And can you tell us why?
The one, I mean, there's many, but the one that I thought was really kind of sad was, we talked about that WASP program. Mm-hmm. And in order for a woman to be accepted into the WASP, the Women's Air Service Pilots, they had to have twice the qualifications a man did to be admitted as a pilot candidate. And so the number of flight hours, they already had to have a pilot's license. They had to have twice the flight hours that a man did. And then they went down to Love Field in Texas, where they basically participated in military training for 6 months. And then after that, they basically flew aircraft around the country. So if someone needed a fighter over here, they would fly it from here to there. A transport plane, they flew all the different aircraft that the military had at that time. And one of the gals from Bemidji here, Ruth, and I'm gonna kill this name because it's K-J-O-M-E, so I'm going to say Comey. She was in charge of the Farm Security Administration office here in Bemidji. And she had taken flying lessons here in town, had her pilot's license. And the funny thing is, actually, she lived three doors down where I live now.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of cool. You know, yeah. I go by the house. Hey, she used to live there. And anyway, she, in the spring of 1944, volunteered and was accepted into the WASP program, went down to Love Field. And they ran two classes at a time. They were, you know, there was Group A and Group B, and one was ahead of the other group. And in December of 1944, the Group A, Ruth was in Group B, Group A graduated. 13 days later, the military cut the WASP program off.
Oh, wow.
So, she never got to graduate. Oh. I mean, she went through all that work and all that effort and all and that volunteerism. And then, 13 days after that, Group A graduated. Then they said the WASP program wasn't needed anymore because they... By that time, we controlled the air over Germany. We controlled the air basically over the Pacific, and we didn't need as many pilots because there were a lot of pilots, men, coming back that could do that job. And once again, we don't want you taking jobs from men. So we're thanks for your service, but go away, kind of a thing. You know, it's just that was just sad to me that all that time and effort, and then right when she's going to graduate, then they cancel the program.
Right.
That is Professor Emeritus Michael Herbert, PhD. He's talking about his new book, They Answered the Call, Minnesota's Beltrami County Women Who Served in the Military During World War II. This is a book containing histories of the women who served from Beltrami County in northern Minnesota. He's in conversation, and we'll hear more now from our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski.
Did you get a sense of some kind of common denominator as far as why these women wanted to serve? I mean, I think there's kind of the obvious, you want to serve their country, especially during a time like that. But was there anything else that really stuck out to you as a motivation for why these women wanted to do this?
Well, without it being written down anywhere, but if you looked at the personalities, and if you read the book, you'll pick up some commonalities between all of those women. They were adventurous. They were very brave. They weren't going to fit into that stereotype. You can be a teacher or secretary or housewife. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were like, no, I'm going to take flying lessons. I'm going to be an army nurse. I'm going to do these things, and I'm going to be sent overseas. And so they were very brave women. And I'm not saying other women weren't. I'm just saying that they were extraordinary in the fact that I'm gonna go do this thing, and I'm gonna face the obstacles. And you can imagine the harassment and all the other things I had to put up with. Because in the 1940s, it was a very different world for women. And the same thing when we were talking about Ruth earlier. After Ruth, the program was cut off, she actually joined the Red Cross and went over to France, still during the war, and served with the Red Cross over there and stayed over in France. And I think she came back in 1946, I think, is when she flew back from France.
How does this kind of research and work support the Bemidji community?
Well, for a number of different reasons. You know, to me personally... I grew up in a military family, and I'm the adjutant for the American Legion Post now. I mean, I volunteer at the Veterans Home. All those kinds of things are very important to me because the military, that's a sacrifice, men and women. And I think it's important that we try to remember these folks. And if it's having a book in the library that if someone gets curious about, well, I heard my grandmother was in the service. Well, there's a resource for you, perhaps. And secondly, I'm not saying this was easy because it took me about 2 years, but people can do this. It's not something like, oh, you've got to be a genius or you've got to be a Stephen King writer or something like that to have that innate skill to be able to do this. It's you know, it's if you're willing to put in the work, you can have something like this, which I think is a value.
That is from our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. We're learning there about Michael Herbert's new book, They Answered the Call, Minnesota's Beltrami County Women Who Served in the Military During World War II. You can find lots more author interviews from Tammy from her segment, What We're Reading. It's available at our website, kaxc.org. It's also a podcast. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for being with us on this Thanksgiving morning. Coming up after 8 o'clock, we bring you a special from our friends at Interlochen Public Radio. This one about a man who watches the sunrise of Lake Superior every single morning. We also will be bringing you some more Minnesota music, music we're grateful for, like Kelly Smith. We receive support from Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji. They offer hot tubs, pool tables, saunas, and more. Learn more online at hottubsmn.com. And support also comes this morning from Lady Sippers, NA Bottle Shop in downtown Deer River. Itasca County's only NA Bottle Shop, offering ready-to-drink options, ingredients for craft cocktails, gifts, and more. Info available at ladysippers.com. Here's Kelly Smith.
Shelter from the cold. Run your fingers through my golden gray. Love, be kind, remember me this way. Steady hands to fill my empty cup. It's enough, love, it's enough. Did we almost lose each other?
Hey, it's News Director Chelsea Perkins from KAXE, and we are celebrating. Because of you, we blew our Give to the Max Day fundraising goal out of the water. Your support does more than keep the lights on. It powers trusted local journalism rooted right here in northern Minnesota. It helps our news desk tell the stories that matter, ask the questions that need to be asked, and amplify voices you don't hear anywhere else. Every dollar that you gave has quadrupled the power thanks to our participation in the National News Match program through the Institute of Nonprofit News. This is an investment in people-powered news, community connection, and the future of public media. There's still time to support KAXE this year. You can make a year-end gift anytime through December 31st at KAXE.org. From all of us at KAXE, thank you for believing in local news.